Good morning. Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams. As New Mexico grapples with a budget crisis, the state is considering whether to save money by making changes to Medicaid, things like charging copays for prescriptions and doctor visits and eliminating dental care for Medicaid recipients. But should people on Medicaid have to pay for their medical care? What would cutting benefits for Medicaid recipients mean for the state's budget and for people who get their health care through the program? We want to hear from you. The number is 877-899-5866. You can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is at KUNM News, and you can also email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. Joining us today in the studio are Abuko Estrada, staff attorney with the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty, Bill Jordan is senior policy advisor with New Mexico Voices for Children, and Sherry Gonzalez, who is an enrollment counselor with Centro Sabila Community Health Clinic in Albuquerque. Okay, so the state is overhauling its Medicaid program, which is called Centennial Care. Let's start with some basics here. Abuko Estrada, can you explain for us how the Medicaid program in New Mexico works?
Sure. And so, you know, just the basics of Medicaid are the fact that it's a public insurance program that provides health care coverage to low-income families, including children, pregnant women, seniors, and people with disabilities. And it's set up as a funded partnership between the state and federal government. The state puts in a certain amount of money, and the federal government matches it with a certain percentage. And so right now, when you take a look at all of our Medicaid categories and people that are eligible, the state's receiving about a 4-to-1 match. So that means for every dollar that we invest into Medicaid, the federal government is paying $4 back to help cover our low-income New Mexicans.
But the money that we, it's like 97-98% that the federal government pays, and we pay the remaining 2 or 3% at this point?
It depends on the category. And so right now it's about 80-20. When you take into consideration all the categories. If we're just talking about the low-income adult expansion category, then it's about 95.5 currently.
It's a huge amount of money even still that the state has to come up with, right? It's like 900-something million dollars just for this year. And we're, I think, $32 million short, so we don't have enough money to really pay our share. And is that why HSD, the Human Services Department, is trying to make these changes that we can get into in just a second? I mean, it's a budget-saving issue, right?
You know, they're certainly trying to do some of this related to the budget, certainly. You know, but at the end of the day, what it is it's making Medicaid worse because all of these changes are just going to end up hindering access to care, which is going to make it harder for our families to get the health care that they need. And it's going to end up in higher administrative costs that are going to negatively impact the state's budget long term.
And what are the changes that HSD wants to make to the Medicaid program?
You know, so, you know, one of the proposals is to impose copays onto families. And then there's also wider changes as part of a Centennial Care renewal application that they're going to submit to the federal government. That's going to impose premiums on families and retroactive coverage, which is coverage that helps keep families out of medical debt. They're also looking at reducing health benefits for our parents and caretakers, as you mentioned, possibly reducing dental coverage as well.
And we did invite the New Mexico Human Services Department's Medicaid supervisor to be on this program, but she said she couldn't join us. Bill Jordan, you work at New Mexico Voices for Children, where you do a lot of research on kids and families. I understand that it's over 70% of new births in New Mexico that are covered by this program. How big of an issue would charging copays and these other changes that Medicaid, that the state wants to make to Medicaid, be for kids?
Well, it would be a real burden for families. I think the real issue is that the state doesn't want to come up with the necessary funding to match with the federal dollars. And so they want to essentially tax or add that additional financial burden onto families who are already struggling, either with a disability or they're elderly or low-income kids and adults. So they just want to shift the burden onto them, and that would be really difficult for those families. It would probably mean that some of them would not get care. You know, our healthcare providers have already taken a pay cut. because the state didn't come up with money last year. And so now they would be burdened with the additional administrative cost of collecting the copays or foregoing that revenue. So it's likely another pay cut for hospitals and doctors.
Hmm. Well, we have a caller on the line from Santa Fe. Nat is with us with a comment on copays. Hi, Nat. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for doing the show. Thank you to your guests as well. I'm a disability advocate. I'm in Santa Fe, but I work with people statewide. But in having copays be necessary for people to receive their medical care will cause them to defer their medical care. Then emergency rooms will become their primary care. And because I'm a disability advocate, of course, my focus is on deferring your medical care can lead to disability, which can lead to further burden to the individual or to families. And we already have in New Mexico, depending on which municipality you're in, between 16 to 24% of the population having a disability. So there you go. Thank you.
Thank you, Nat. Would these changes impact with people that have disabilities? I know that there are exemptions, like people below the poverty line and certain other things. I think intellectual disabilities is one of the things the state said wouldn't have to pay copays. Abuko, I mean, is this for everybody?
And so some of the copays would apply to the working disabled population, and so certainly they would be impacted. And really, all copays and fees are going to hinder all New Mexican families, but they're going to particularly hit families with chronic health conditions particularly hard because of the amount of medical care that they need. So,
what happens if you get charged a copay and you can't pay it? I mean, does that end up going to a collection agency, or what's the process there? I mean, I can imagine people not knowing that they're going to have to pay, not having the money, and not paying their bills. What would that mean? Anybody can take that.
I think to some extent the copays are small, and so the families, if they can't come up with the money, even though it may be small for you and I, it's a burden for them. If they seek care, the doctor may not be able to collect it. It may be too small to send a collection, and so it ends up being a cut for providers. One of the issues with that is that we need providers to want to accept patients who are on Medicaid. And if they keep getting pay cuts, as they have in the last year, and now they have the added administrative burden of collecting copays, they're much, much less likely to want to accept Medicaid patients. We need to make this system work more easily for everybody.
Sherry Gonzalez, you work at a community health clinic. Are you seeing these kinds of concerns in terms of maybe not seeking out medical help because of concerns over cost in the community you're working with?
So I do see this in my job. I often get patients who ask, or clients, because I don't directly see patients, who ask, is there copays? Do I have to pay a premium? And when people do come in, it's often a burden to even come in. I have some folks having 5-6 appointments because they couldn't get there. And it's something that I try to work with them. Hey, what do you need? Do I go pick you up? Do I go to your house? What can I do? Because it's something that is really important to me to get folks covers. And I think with some of the providers that I've spoken to, that it's really up to the provider on how they bill these copays that are being charged by other insurance companies. And I've seen some of my clients with other insurance companies not able to pay these things. And it's something that they'll get a bill for whatever their copay was. And I believe that some of the providers, it may be up to them to actually enforce it. To some providers have things on their walls saying it's due at the time of service. If you don't have it, you'll get turned away. I've seen other clinics that charge copays that try to shame folks into having the copays, and their frontline personnel may be trained to really loudly say, oh, you don't have your copay today, then we're going to have to reschedule.
What's the impact of having to reschedule on clients that are seeking medical help?
That's taking more time off of their job. That's taking more time away from their families. There's another expense into either getting a ride, paying for gasoline, going on the bus, however they got there. It's an additional expense all the way around.
And we've heard lots of resistance to these policies, to these proposed policy changes from healthcare providers. Is most of, I know like 25 providers or something like that, I think, Abuko signed on to a letter that the Center on Law and Poverty sent to HSD in opposition to these changes. Is this mostly just around administrative burdens? I mean, you've talked a little bit about this, but what is the big problem from a provider standpoint in terms of charging copays, premiums, whatever else the state wants to do?
You know, I mean, it's a burden, certainly, on the administrative level, you know, and that's with providers, and that's also with the state. It's going to cost the state more to try to collect these fees than their purported savings. And then for providers, as Bill Jordan said, you know, it's something that they may not be able to collect, and it ends up just being a cut to them. But the big picture is that it's the most burdensome on our families, you know. Our families are going to end up having to forego care or lose their Medicaid coverage because they can't pay these fees, which is going to lead to them not getting their needed treatment and the state paying for costlier care down the road.
We have Maggie McCohen on the phone. She is with the New Mexico Behavioral Health Providers Association. Hey, Maggie.
Good morning.
We were just talking about the impacts that these proposals could have to healthcare providers. You work with behavioral health. I mean, why are the proposed changes to Medicaid a concern from a behavioral health standpoint?
Well, for some of the reasons that the other panel members just talked about, if an individual, a consumer, arrives for an appointment and it's a behavioral health appointment, it's critical that that individual be seen and be involved in their treatment plan. Many of our providers are very concerned that first, some of their clients simply will not have the fee available. Secondly, that there is a real impact if we're going to suggest turning people away if they don't have it. And third, the administrative burden is huge for behavioral health providers because there has to be tracking systems set up to track who's making their copays. What happens if we see someone, if a provider sees someone and they haven't made their copay, or are we going to get reimbursed for that service? And that leads to the administrative burden, which is the number one issue that providers are, probably number two issue that behavioral health providers are experiencing since the 2013 allegations of Medicaid fraud.
Yeah, can you briefly describe what the 2013 allegations are and what they have done to the behavioral health industry?
There were allegations made against 15 agencies, some of the largest and longest-term providers of service in New Mexico, that there were significant allegations or indications of Medicaid fraud. And prior to any due process afforded to the agencies, their services and reimbursement was cut off by the state, and most of them went out of business. They were the state subsequently brought in several providers from out of state, and when they did that, all of those clients had to change providers. We lost, when I say lost, we don't know if they're receiving service. There's not a really good accounting of who was receiving service prior to them as there is now, but our indications are that there's been a real drop in the number of encounters provided to individuals, particularly in the adult categories. It was a devastating impact in terms of loss of service, and the provider network is regrouping. It's building. I think the state and the managed care organizations definitely want to see services in place, but it's been a very difficult process. And as I said, a big concern is the administrative burden, because with every type of regulation imposed by the state or by the managed care organizations, and even more so when they are not consistently enforced or provided to all the providers, then the providers assume the cost of getting the clarification and trying to get things worked out.
So in a nutshell, you're saying that because of all the problems that happened a few years ago in the behavioral health system, providers of that kind of health care are just not in a position to comply with the things that the state wants
right.
them
I mean,
to do.
We would definitely try to comply, but it's really unclear who's going to bear the cost of trying to collect what we anticipate, as someone said, monies that's not going to offset the cost of collecting it.
We're talking
not
about...
not to mention the fact that people that are using Medicaid need the support, and we need to be able to provide it. That's the goal of providing, making access to care an important goal for everyone. And I think there are serious issues with how these proposals would enhance access to care.
Well, we're talking about the proposed cuts to the state's Medicaid program and what they would mean for the budget, for people on Medicaid, and for the healthcare system in general. Abuko Estrada of New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty is with us. So is Bill Jordan of New Mexico Voices for Children and Sherry Gonzalez with Central Sabila. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Support comes from Los Alamos National Laboratory, presenting public talks from July 24th through July 28th on whether there's weather in space in Santa Fe, Los Alamos, and Albuquerque. More information at frontiers.lanl.gov.
I'm Tara Gatewood, host of Native America Calling. On our next program, we'll visit with the Native author, Lewis V. Clark III, about his book, How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. The book is a weaving of words that paint a clear view into his life, and it takes the shape of verse and prose. Find out more on our July Book of the Month.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. We're talking about what charging copays and cutting services would mean for people on Medicaid. Should the state charge low-income people for doctor visits? If you or someone you know gets health care through Medicaid, could you afford to pay a copay? What about a monthly premium? Give us a call now. The number is 877-899-5866. You can also tweet us your comments or questions at KUNM News. And let's go to the phones. Philip Cassidy is on the line with us. Hi, Philip.
Hi.
You're a student at Highlands University, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a Master's of Social Work student at New Mexico Highlands University.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, right now I'm actually going through a life transition where I quit my job as an educational assistant to focus on my Master's of Social Work. So my health insurance covered through my previous employment actually expires at the end of this month. So I decided to switch to Medicaid because I currently have no income. So right now, I'm actually relying on public benefits to help me get through a very difficult financial time in my life. Even, for instance, yesterday, I needed to see one of my health care providers to receive services, and I still have this copay from Blue Cross Blue Shield, which expires, but the copay is $50, and I actually only have $4 to my name for this month, so I didn't have the money to actually go see my health care provider yesterday. So thinking about switching over to Medicaid and knowing how hard copayments are for me, I really do fear that additional copayments added to Medicaid would just be a major barrier for me when I really need to see my health care providers.
You know, the copays aren't always that much, just $5, $20, or I can't remember the exact, Buka, you probably know the exact numbers, I think $5 to $50, depending on what you're doing. Would even that, you said you had $4 to your name, Philip, would $5 be too much, something you couldn't swing?
Oh, definitely, way too much. I would be sacrificing, money that I would need to spend on feeding myself, for instance.
So how are you getting by right now without the money for doctor visits? Is that something you can handle?
No, not really. I've been having to reach out for support from others in my life, like immediate family or close friends that can help me out and support me financially. But in terms of my own support, it's very difficult right now until I receive any type of student loans.
And Maggie from the Behavioral Health Association, Providers Association, this sounds kind of like what you were talking about earlier. And you too, Sherry, the kind of clients that you see going through this problem. I mean, does this sound familiar, what Philip is going through right now?
It definitely does. When I see people and I ask them very pointed questions, because doing the application, there's very specific questions about income in a lot of aspects of their lives. And they say, well, I don't have any money in my checking. It's a negative. I don't have any money in my savings. I don't have any money right now. It's a negative. I've had to borrow from my friends. This is very common for me.
Well, Philip, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. What are people supposed to do? Does the state have a plan to deal with people in Philip's situation that can't swing a copay? I mean, what happens? Everyone, do they just end up in the emergency room? I haven't seen anything about how to deal with this problem that everybody's bringing up.
Am I able to chime in?
Yeah.
Cool. One thing I really wanted to mention is that copayments have this multiplier effect in my life. So if I go into an urgent care clinic today to get services, I will be charged a $50 copay. If I can't pay that $50 copay, I can still be seen, but that $50 doesn't leave. And so I can basically go again, and it'd be another $50 copay. And once it's at 100, usually at the urgent care clinic I go to, they request that I pay at least 50 before they see me again without me paying a copayment. So I think it's really important to mention that copayments do have a multiplier effect on me. So even if I don't pay the first one, it's not like it goes away. It stays around, and then another 50 gets added on top.
How much money would this would these copayments save, Abuko?
You know, the state is saying up to $1.5 million for the copay proposal. But again, because of the fact that folks like Philip and our New Mexican families are really doing the best that they can with limited resources and may go without care, it's going to end up costing the state more than that down the road.
So the numbers don't add up in your view?
Absolutely not. While copays, ranging from $5 to $50 may not seem like a lot for some families, they really do become unmanageable for a lot of folks and add up quickly, especially for people with disabilities or chronic health conditions that have to take multiple visits to the doctor or need multiple prescriptions. And, our family shouldn't have to choose between rent, food, or gas.
Yeah. Well, we did want to have the state on to talk about their plan and how they came up with it and what their strategy was, but they did not agree to be on the show with us. But, we do have a financial problem here, right? I mean, almost half the population of New Mexico is now covered by Medicaid, and that number is just going to grow and grow. The costs are going to grow and grow. Our economy is stagnant. This is a real problem that the state's trying to address. So what ways forward are there if the math, as you're saying, doesn't add up?
So it's, sensible budget solutions. I think our policymakers need to get together, put together a revenue package that doesn't harm our families. Right now, what the Medicaid changes are doing is trying to balance the budget on the backs of hardworking New Mexicans, and that's absolutely unacceptable. We have ways forward to build the revenue that doesn't hurt our families.
Yeah, but Medicaid is just huge. I mean, for a state like New Mexico, almost $1 billion a year, we just don't have that kind of money.
But think about all of the good things that Medicaid does. We're providing coverage to over 900,000 New Mexicans. The program supports over 50,000 jobs and is bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue to the state that we wouldn't have otherwise.
Let's go to the phones again. Lisa Uvall is with us. And Lisa, you are with the Coalition to End Homelessness. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. What are your concerns for people experiencing homelessness in terms of the policy changes that HSD is proposing here?
Yeah, well, like others have already talked about this morning, we're certainly really concerned about the premiums and the copays. I think that it is deceptive. They seem like they're nominal, $5, but like others have been saying, if you have very limited income, $5 is, of course, a large amount of money. And then if you're talking about folks with disabilities or chronic health conditions, going to the doctor several times over the course of the month, that can really add up. And so I think we're worried about the fact that these fees could be almost impossible for people experiencing homelessness to pay, and I think it's one more barrier to exiting homelessness. But I'm also really concerned about how it could put people at risk for homelessness. I think it's important to keep in mind that many low-income folks in New Mexico are paying more than 50% of their income towards rent. So they're already on a very tight budget. There's really not a lot of extra money available for additional expenses. So if you increase any part of their budget, including healthcare costs, that may cause people to lose their housing because they can't meet their rent. I also feel like some of the other things that the HSD is proposing, like ending the retroactive coverage and the transitional coverage, which is for folks that are, working and increasing their income, it gives them some time to transition out of Medicaid, as well as reducing benefits for parents, is just really concerning and, like, frankly, really counterproductive to, I think, a shared goal of helping people exit homelessness. And one of the things that struck me when I was reading about the reduction in benefits is they're proposing eliminating or significantly reducing vision care for parents, including no longer covering eyeglasses. And that really resonated with me because I have terrible eyesight and I couldn't do my job without some eyeglasses. So if we're not helping people meet their basic medical needs, how can we be expecting them, you know, to get back to work, support themselves and their families, and maintain their housing? So I think a lot of these policies are just extremely short-sighted.
We have a Twitter comment from, well, first let's go to you, Shannon. I'm sorry, you were waving your hand.
Sherry. You call me Jen.
I mean, Sherry. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So the retroactive coverage that Lisa was talking about, I see a lot of that. And it's usually people who come in who are in the hospital. It's babies who were born like at the end of the month, or if
and, their and you're talking retroactive coverage, meaning if you sign up for Medicaid and you have like it'll cover some an accident or something that happened to you before you signed up.
It may cover bills from up to 3 months before.
Okay.
In this is something that I actually see a lot, because people come to me after they've been in the hospital and discharged. Parents come to me after their children have been born. And this is something that is really, really beneficial for the families that I see. It's something that helps them live. It's a really, really important. And to talk about the vision care and dental care, it's really unfortunate that even in mainstream insurance, this is often considered a luxury. But we need our eyes and we need our teeth. It's not something, it's a part of our bodies. It's not something that's outside of us that we cannot function without.
Let's go to the phone lines again. We have a call from David, who is calling from Albuquerque.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a great conversation. I think that it's important that we remember that the income support division of HSD is currently, under consent decree, legal sanction by the feds and the courts for failing to accurately process applications for benefits, including Medicaid. And the same system would be the system that is tracking and processing these copays. So we're relying on essentially a broken system to implement this strategy. How about ISD process these things accurately and effectively before they add more burden onto patients that it potentially affects their access to Medicaid?
Thank you very much, David, for that. And let's go to another call on a similar vein. Luis, from Albuquerque. Luis, you have a comment on increasing taxes?
Yes, my name is Luis, and thank you again for calling. First of all, if we had universal health care, we won't have to talk about all this, okay? And also the fact that Senator McCain just had his surgery, and all that, and he's a multimillionaire, and all the senators are, congressional people are, and they don't have to worry about that. Our taxes, we can increase our taxes through various ways, okay? One of the important ways is cut down on military spending. I mean, we just had another aircraft carrier we don't need that could pay for every health care forever here in the United States and certainly here in New Mexico. Also, property taxes. Churches go without paying any property taxes. We're going to start considering taxing churches maybe the church itself, but they have all the other property we can tax, and also the big box stores and you know, gasoline and what have you. We can raise the taxes, and it'd be easier. It's too hard for people that are low income to have another added burden on them. You know, healthcare is very important. It ought to be universal.
Well, Governor Martinez has been running and governing on a no-tax platform. Bill, I know you've written about this. What's your view here?
Yeah, well, I think it's really important that we recognize how we got here in the first place. What the state is trying to do is shift the financial burden onto families. And the reason is because the state is broke. And we're broke because we gave away hundreds of millions of dollars to the well-connected and out-of-state corporations. Governor Martinez likes to say she cut taxes 37 times. None of your listeners got any of those tax cuts, by the way, unless you got really wealthy folks with big businesses. They didn't get any of those tax cuts. And what she won't tell you is that now that we've given that money away in failed tax cuts, we're broke. What's worse is that we were told that those tax cuts were going to create jobs, and we got no jobs. We're last or second last in the nation in job growth. We have the second highest unemployment in the nation. And she continues to cling to this political ideology that says she won't raise taxes, even when the hospitals and the doctors are begging her to tax them in order to save Medicaid and shore up the healthcare industry in the state. She vetoed the legislation that they themselves requested. They said, tax us to fund Medicaid. The legislature, in a bipartisan fashion, passed that legislation, and she vetoed it.
Well, we have a Twitter comment right along those lines from Colin, who says that earlier this year, hospitals were begging to be taxed to avoid Medicaid cuts. And so we've gotten some feedback on that level, but you know, we did want the state to come and talk on this conversation. They did not come to be a part of the show. But, you know, we have a Democratic-controlled legislature in both chambers. Like, we can't really pin this completely on the governor.
Well, I think that the policies over the last couple of years have really taken the state into a bit of a death spiral. We've been giving the money away at the same time as gas and oil prices dropped. We found ourselves unable to pay the bills. And so we made deep cuts to K-12, deep cuts to higher ed, public safety, and now to healthcare. The simple solution, the correct solution, I think, the prudent solution is to raise new revenue.
Would the money that we would have if the tax cut, the corporate tax cuts and the things you're mentioning were not in place, be enough to cover the huge bill we owe for our Medicaid population?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've literally given away hundreds of millions of dollars. And as Abuko stated earlier, the copays are only going to save the state a couple of million dollars, $1 or $2 million. So there's a real disconnect here. And I know the governor likes to say she's not going to raise taxes, but we've had cuts to providers. That's like a tax increase to them. We've had 45% increase in tuition in our universities in the last few years. That's like a tax increase to university students. And we've had now a proposal for copays, which is like a tax on low-income families.
Sherry, you work at Centro Savila. It's a community health clinic. Have you been contending with these kinds of cost increases or taxes, as Bill says, in the work that you do? And is that affecting patients?
Well, that's not something I directly deal with in terms of the taxes. But when I deal with clients, it's something that I deal with small businesses a lot. And it's something that you spend a lot of time with a small business going over their receipts, going over things if they haven't filed their taxes. Because for small businesses, this is a really giant tax burden we have. If we can give big box store credits, tax credits, what's going on with our small businesses? Because that's a backbone of our communities. It's something that we're seeing mom and pop shops closing. Well, why is this going on? And with this current administration, these are not new problems, but where does the buck stop? It's how are we really, really taxing our communities? We have a lot of people paying so much for their small businesses that they are on public benefits. And that's something that's a little bit ridiculous when you're talking about who's actually keeping this community going. It are these small businesses. You see them closing everywhere, and it saddens me because I'm in the South Valley. I love the South Valley. I grew up there. And looking left and right and seeing all of these things close, we're in a food desert there. We're seeing a lot of our small stores close, a lot of our small things closing because they can't handle the tax burden. So it's something that I do see often.
You're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show. We are live from the University of New Mexico, and we're talking about the state's proposed changes to New Mexico's Medicaid program and what those changes could mean for people here. We want to hear from you. Do you or someone you know get their health care through Medicaid? Did you know the state is considering cutting benefits and charging for Medicaid coverage? What's your reaction? The number to call is 877-899-5866, or send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support comes from New Mexico Jazz Workshop, presenting Jazz Under the Stars this Saturday, July 29th, featuring the Charles McPherson Quintet and the KBG Trio at the Albuquerque Museum. Tickets at the door or holdmyticket.com. It's not every day you have a car to donate. In fact, it may be once in a lifetime. But when the time comes, do yourself and KUNM a favor. Donate it to keep great programs like this one on the air. If you itemize deductions, you'll get a sizable tax deduction, plus we'll give you a KUNM membership as our thanks for your special gift. Because it is special to donate your longtime car or truck. When you're ready, call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
When Czech composer Antonín Dvořák was here in the U.S., an African-American student sang spirituals for him. Dvořák had those songs in mind when he wrote his New World Symphony. We'll hear it, plus a new piece inspired by the man who sang for Dvořák, Harry T. Burley, on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth investigative coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. Give us a ring, 877-899-5866. You can also send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our Facebook page. What do you think about proposals to charge copays to Medicaid recipients? Are you a healthcare provider? What would this mean for your work? Let's go to the phones. We have Shannon Flegg on the line with us, and Shannon is with the Native Health Alliance. Hi, Shannon.
Good morning. Yep, I'm actually with the Native Health Initiative.
Oh, Initiative. I'm sorry. I got the name wrong. So how would changing Medicaid impact Native people, Shannon?
Well, I think one of the things is knowing, you know, we are a nonprofit organization and we're based here in Albuquerque, but we do local, state, and national levels of work, but we use the love-funded aspect. You know, being with a nonprofit that is love-funded, one of the things we always strive for and advocate for on behalf of families and also individuals and community is actually the access and knowing that, you know, everyone has a basic right to health care. And we know with changes that actually does affect certain populations, but moreover, the population of the older, those that are considered poor or in the poverty state, and then those in worse health and vulnerable health conditions. And so one of the things I think of immediately is, you know, being Native myself, I'm Diné, but it's just, you know, the question is, you know, my home community is not going to need better health care nor better health insurance to improve their health. What it needs is improved health by addressing the social determinants of health.
Well, would IHS or any tribal programs that are out there be able to buffer some of the impacts that you're talking about? I mean, is there support for tribal communities that could help if these copays and premiums and all the other things are instituted?
I think that's actually an interesting question to look at, because one of the things is actually all the nations and all the tribes and urban associations are very different, and they're all sovereign nations, and so they all have to be. One of the things I think is to actually really look at how IHS or even urban centers, as well as Public Law 638 facilities, as well as tribal communities, need to continue to be, you know, kind of up to date on the actual changes that are happening at a state level, as well as at a national level. Regardless of being a Native American community, clinic, hospital, urban center, or an organization. I think it's also important for them to understand how to communicate with key political leaders, both at the tribal level and at the community level. And just to, the one thing is knowing that, you know, even though they say the Medicaid is not going to, and this change in Medicaid is not going to affect Native Americans, but I know with a proposition to change, I think it's based upon a challenge that the language has to continue to be in there to remind folks that, you know, that the Native Americans in terms of being charged should not be charged based upon the obligations and the, you know, with the way that the actual wording for Native Americans would not pay a copay under the certain plan.
Well, thanks a lot, Shannon. Shannon with the Native Health Initiative. We have some other calls to get to, and let's go to Bonnie, who's in El Prado. Bonnie, are you with us?
Good morning, and Hi. Thank you for hosting this very important conversation. I just want to make a couple of comments. I worked in long-term health care for many years, and most of the residents were on Medicaid. If you have a healthy population, you're going to have people who can participate in good citizenry. They can work. They can take care of their children. They can live a long and healthy life. And when I say a healthy population, that includes taking care of dental care and eye care. And there was a caller a few calls back who had mentioned John McCain being able to have his surgery. And this is something that every citizen of this country should have access to. And in this day, I don't understand it. And it breaks my heart that we're having this discussion, that it's not accessible, and that our state is so poor that we can't have this for our children. And everybody, not just in our state, but everywhere in this country. And I just want to say one more thing, please, and that is that if we don't elect a governor in 2018 who will raise property taxes, including on churches, and will I think we need to legalize marijuana and get the marijuana bump. So much money is going to Colorado. We need that money in this state. Whether you smoke it, ingest it, or don't use it, it needs to be in New Mexico. We need that money here, and it could help resolve a lot of the issues we're talking about.
Thanks for your call, Bonnie. Chris is also on the line with us. Chris, you're a doctor in Santa Fe?
Yeah, I'm a family practitioner. Been here since 81. I came as a National Health Service Corps provider, fulfilling a medical school scholarship. I then had my own 501c3 nonprofit clinic, the only time anybody's ever done that on their own in New Mexico. And then I've been in private practice since.
How do you feel about the copay proposal?
Copays, okay, with the exception of disabled people and homeless people who can't come up with the money, I don't think it's a financial burden on my Medicaid patients. And as I said previously, the average, or mostly, almost all of my Medicaid patients and I see lots of them, and I've always taken unlimited numbers. I have no restrictions, and I lose money on every Medicaid patient. For those people out there who want to know, we don't make a cent. We lose money. It costs more to see Medicaid patients. But it's a noble calling, and I'm willing to support the system. But a $5 copay for people is a behavioral modification. It teaches people to be a little more responsible for making their appointments, keeping their appointments, showing up, and not going to the emergency room. And too much time has been wasted not teaching our patients who get free care and who demand a lot of services under the free care model of Medicaid to just be more responsible. The emergency rooms shouldn't be seeing people with earaches and colds and things like that. It's over-tested, underwhelming care, minimal examination, expensive, and then you have dentists who will only do medical procedures like caps and crowns on kids down to age two. They'll only do it in the hospital where they put them under general anesthesia because they get paid a profit, where they won't do it in their office like they would for a private dental patient.
Well, because so we
the
just
system, $5 copay is not significant to my patients on Medicaid, and I've been doing this for 37 years.
A few minutes ago on the show, we heard from a guy named Philip, who is a graduate student at New Mexico Highlands. He said he only had $4 to his name. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of people would say, hey, going and getting a degree, that is being responsible, and that's a financial sacrifice.
Okay.
I mean, so what's your response to that?
So my average Medicaid patient, the vast majority of them, sit in my exam rooms with iPhones, and it's almost always iPhones, not other versions. So you got $600 or $700 phones, and I have two-year-olds, three-year-olds sitting there playing on iPhones. Do you think a $5 copayment is even relevant to somebody who can afford that who's on Medicaid? People who drive in, and I can see out of my exam rooms into my parking lot, people who drive in invariably are in SUVs or rather fancy cars. So the system is either giving too many people Medicaid who don't financially qualify or who fake their way into the system, or a $5 copay is not relevant. And premiums are a whole different issue, but behavioral modification is what it's all about. If you can train people, as I spend a lot of time doing, don't go to the emergency room for nothing. Come to us. We have emergency slots every day.
Right. Well,
I have a system so that I can see people now.
Yeah.
Today.
I think we got it, Chris.
Not next week. Not next month. Now.
Yeah. We hear you there. And, you know, guys, Chris is saying, speaking from experience, his patients can't afford this copay. And, you know, he's losing money as a practitioner. So, I mean, how do you respond to that?
Mine is more, I don't want to politicize this, but that's often something that you hear is the myth of the bootstraps. It's like, oh, well, this is behavior modification. Okay, they have iPhones. Oh, they have SUVs. How do you know that they didn't have these things before they got on Medicaid and lost a job? We're supposed to be living in a classless society, but let's face it, this is a class society. If McCain can get his very expensive surgery on mainly the United States, the taxpayers' dime, because they have really good health coverage, it's something that, hey, maybe you don't get that job because you have a clunker. How many times have I seen my patients, my family, me pulled over because you have a car that's not as functioning as other people? So to me, it's more of a political issue of, hey, did they get it before? Did they get it after? How are you questioning your patients more than you're questioning the system?
I mean, this is a tricky question, you know, I mean, because you're going to have people like Chris, doctors who say that their experience is not reflective of what you guys are saying. I mean, and you guys talk to a lot of people, too. I'm not sure how we find a way out of this. Bill?
Well, you know, New Mexico has the second highest rate of child poverty in the nation. We're a very poor state. We have a lot of needs. And I would hope that we would not resort to stereotyping those who are poor or disabled or elderly and recognize that our problem is poverty. And we should be attacking poverty, and we should have a plan for attacking poverty and its consequences, not the people who live in poverty. And one of the ways, one of the most important ways that we can address poverty is to make sure that our kids get a healthy start in life and they're not burdened with illness or the inability to get to the doctor and get the kind of developmental care that they really need. And that's what we're really talking about here, is whether or not our kids and those who are disabled and elderly are going to get access to care. And that's the solution, not the problem.
Shannon Flagg of the Native Health Initiative, are you still on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
What's your response to the caller we had earlier who says that, you know, a lot of his patients on Medicaid could afford to pay a copay?
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because when he talks about free, especially for the Native population, I have to think about, you know, there are federally recognized tribes, but there's also state-recognized and unrecognized, and those that identify as being Native American, this might still affect them. And so when we talk about populations, Indian Health Service, 638, as well as urban health centers, they only cover only so much of the population. And so there are those that are not just only poor. I remember being a recipient at one time for Medicaid because I didn't have insurance. And I know that process, and it's very difficult even in a working class setting and having to experience that. It's very interesting to see that, you know, when you talk about Native Americans and free health care, not everyone is getting free health care or access to health care also. And that really is something that I think that we should look at when we talk about Native American and the language that is really looking at Native American, Alaskan Native, and the process of this change. So I think it's really going to affect and influence not just the political aspect, but also the people that are in not only New Mexico, but at a national level.
Thanks, Shannon. I want to squeeze Ellen in on the phone before we have to end the program. Ellen is calling from Albuquerque. Ellen, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about the high cost of dental care. What happens is sometimes, even if you have insurance, sometimes the out-of-pocket cost can be anywhere from $100 to $300. And that doesn't always sit well if you are in a bracket where you don't qualify for Medicaid because you make too much money from your Social Security, but yet at the same time, by the time you pay your rent and your bills, you don't have a whole lot for the rest of your money goes for groceries or other needed expenses.
Right. Well, Ellen, I hate to cut you off. I appreciate your thought there, but we're out of time. And I do want to ask before we end, Abuko Estrada, what's the state's timeline for implementing these changes? Where are we? What's next?
So the copays, they're planning on implementing as of October 1st of this year. As for the other changes, they're going to draft a new application that they release in September, take some more public comment in October before submitting the application to the federal government in November later this year.
Okay, well, we'll be keeping you updated here at KUNM News on that development as it happens. If you missed part of this program or you want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, KUNM.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. Marino Spencer engineered the program today. Rashad Mahmoud answered the phones. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation. Find out more online at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thank you so much for listening.